Accession number 9420, reel 11.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 11. I wonder now if you could describe to me the preparations for and actions of August the 8th.
Well, we didn't have a lot of notice of this, but when we did, it was very compact, and we knew there was going to be a big advance. We were really going to end it, the Jerry, you know. The guns were behind us, and packed wheel to wheel, as according to the rumours that drifted through. And on the morning of the 8th, that was the day, and we were warned the day before there was going to be an attack the next morning. And we were packed into the trenches during the night. We moved up. As soon as darkness fell, we moved up. And that was the trouble that we had. We had to do all this action and concentrate between dusk and 4:30 the following morning, when the barrage opened up. And we all took that intervening period, filling up the trenches. We were packed in like sardines. And we had our orders: you don't move until you hear the whistle blow, and then over the top. So, right, we all got packed in. That's where my mate got, you know. Anyway, the guns opened up.
Could you tell me what happened? Because you've mentioned it before. Is this where your friend had his head?
That's right, where it was.
This was while you were in the trenches?
In the same trench, yes. And I think there were one or two other casualties, but I remember this vividly because the sergeant come and pulled his pocketbook out and he said, "Private Thirsk." And I said, "Christ, that's my mate." And then the next, before I could get over the shop or anything, or get a shot, feel the effects of it, the whistle blew and we went over.
Was that part of a heavy bombardment?
Yes, well, I was just about to say, you know, that first of all, before any bombardment took place, the tanks went in, and we could hear them there rumbling and rattling along because they made a noise, you know. I think they were Churchill tanks, I'm not sure. I'm almost sure they were. And there was quite a large number of tanks. There was a very good armament set up there for that attack, and it was a good job we did. I mean, otherwise we'd have never broken down that belt of wire, because when we did get there, the wire was just smashed down all over the place. There were certain parts of it still standing. That's why we knew it was so thick. And we didn't realise, you know, what was in front of us. And we, you know, the thought passed your mind, if you had to go and attack that, how could you get through it? And of course, the tanks fortunately solved that problem. But the Jerry-O had the tanks, and he opened up. And he really pelted us. He put a barrage up there. And He mixed a lot. There was whiz-bangs and long 9.2s and long ranges and everything he opened up, because he knew something was going to happen. He had an idea, mind you. And, of course, there was the Somme. We still had to cross that, you see. This was the Battle of the Somme. And of course, the whistle blew, as I said, and we went over the top then. And, of course, there was losses and all of it, but you just carried on. There was a heavy mist swirling about. You had to be very careful not to shoot your own people, because you didn't know what direction. You could easily lose your way. In fact, we did get lost, and we had to be picked, you know, rejoined afterwards when the mist cleared away and the action. But there was a lot of action, and there was dead and dying all over the place. I found a German officer with his lung hanging out. He was still alive, but he wasn't conscious. And I had, of course, we had revolvers then with the Lewis gun. And that was nearest I came to ever shooting a man, you know, point blank, without him, you know, being a more almost unconscious target. Because you could see his lung was going, expanding and contracting as he was breathing. And his chest had been torn right open with a shell. He was an officer, definitely. And, you know, I had half a mind to shoot him, but we had to go on. You couldn't wait for things like that, and it was just one of those things that, that remained in my mind after we'd gone on. And, of course, there were days of it then. We went on for days, you know, in that attack.
What were the German lines like, the Hindenburg line itself, when you got to it?
Well, that was the Hindenburg line was
the actual
a wire.
Trench.
Was wire. That was the Hindenburg line. But behind it, of course, they had their usual system of trenches and dugouts, and some of them were made in concrete, and they'd really entrenched themselves, you know. They had a marvellous system of dugouts. And, of course, you had to winkle out, make sure. And the Jerrys had two options. They could stay down there and let you drop a grenade down and winkle them out, well, finish them off. Or they could come out if they knew it was too heavy, you know, for them, and it was hopeless, with their hands up. And then you'd just... there were parties of Germans passing us then in charge of one British NCO. It was humorous, really, to see those fellas wouldn't have stood a chance, because the Germans had to, obviously, had to throw away their arms. They were all unarmed. But there was one one Tommy, or perhaps an NCO, or you didn't, you know, it's just sort of thing that passed by as you were advancing. All you was looking for was it onward, progress, advancing. And, of course, firing were going on all over the place. Shells were still dropping. And some of Jerry's long-range stuff had dropped in amongst you, you know. If it didn't hit you with the short-range stuff, which was going over your head, it got you the other way. And that's where the casualties came from. Excuse me, but there you are. And
how far did you actually advance on that first day?
Oh, we went a very good distance. I mean, considering we were all on foot, there was no transport. Everything you did at was foot slogged, and you went until you got an order to stop. And you might take one or two lines of Jerry. It all depends on what the resistance was. You see, it was all gauged by resistance, and the situation as to whether you were being held up on your right or left, and sometimes.
So you got to the German second line this time?
Oh, yes, yes. We were still belting them. Our artillery was still going over, you know, and it was hell, you know. You couldn't hear yourself speak, and shells were exploding all round you, and there was smoke and shouting and hollering and all this kind of thing, you know, and it was a real good old battle, really. And... you know, it got hold of you, sort of. You just knew that you got to get on, and you were making advances instead of sitting on your backside in the trench, you know, and waiting for something to happen. There was a certain amount of excitement in this that removed fear.
Did you actually get through all the German defences, or were there still organised German defences in front of you when you did stop?
Oh, no, we cleared the lot in front of us. I can only speak for our sector, because we...
So there were no more German... No organised German
No
defense.
Opposition, no. Not only sporadic firing. And sometimes you would get machine gun posts that could hold you up for perhaps an hour or two. And, you know, unless somebody stopped them, and we usually called on the artillery to do that if we couldn't get near enough to ship them. And it's not easy to dislodge a machine gun post, because they had pillboxes as well behind this belt of wire. I mean, they had a very well organised... They never thought we'd get through the Hindenburg line, you know. And you've got to hand it to them that they put up a resistance and a line there that was very, very difficult. And I think our people realised that it took all that we got and that they produced to shift it, which we did eventually. Because from then on, it was advance. From then on, it was always advance. And for weeks we were... I think I was in the line 6 weeks after that, before we got a break.
Can you tell me how you existed during this period, then? How you got your supplies and...
Oh, well, that was all well organised also, I think. Mind you, there was casualties among those people, you know, and when the cooks were doing a marvellous job in sending us up rations. And, well, we got a chance to break for about perhaps an afternoon or a whole day before we went on the next day. I mean, that's when we used to make up for lost time and have a good old gorge when they got the rations up to us. They were very good that way. In some cases, they couldn't get any rations up to us, and you relied, I bet me iron rations, because there's been nothing else and no hope of getting stuff up. And on the other end, water. You couldn't get water up either. I think that was the time when I'm not sure, I'm a bit mixed up about that dysentery. I know that we had some difficult times when we were advancing, and I think it might have been during the 8th big advance when we were moving so fast that, and advancing where we were isolated once or twice and got cut off because of the rapidity of the advance in some places and not in others. I know we got cut off. We couldn't get back and we couldn't get forward. We were pinned down. And that's when...
Is this the whole battalion or your company?
Well, as far as I know, it was the whole battalion because it was a very big area, you know. And it was an old battlefield as well. You see, Jerry had built up his Hindenburg line after the earlier actions in 1917 and 16. You see, this is... it was a battle-strewn area, and there was very little opportunity or facility around there. No French villages, nowhere where you could find food of any kind. Even the things that we began to get hold of afterwards, and we made some more progress with the big advance. When Jerry had cleared all the villages as he went in the beginning, and set fire to some of the houses. And, of course, we found deserted villages with perhaps a couple of dogs or a cat running around. And I found that when I went into a house to search it, there was a cattle was still on the hob singing. You know, the fire, the range was on light. And, of course, fortunately, on one occasion like that, we were halted. And they were waiting to straighten the line out a bit, but we took the opportunity, because they couldn't get grub. We didn't wait for the rations to come up. We dug the carrots and onions and potatoes up out the gardens and the bits of allotments that the froggies had used there. And we caught the rabbits and chickens, wrung their neck and skinned them and put them in the pot, and we was eating them in about hours after that. And, of course, we really helped ourselves. It was war. It wasn't our property, but there you are. That's what happens. It becomes your property as soon as the war.
When you did eat the iron rations, what were they like? Were they satisfactory?
They were iron. But they served to fill a hole in the, you know...
What, you mean they were iron tablets, or just they were...
No, biscuits. These were square biscuits, about 3 inches across, you know, square 3-inch biscuits. They were the iron rations and your water bottle. That was you... You stand by, not to use your water until you were absolutely compelled, the last resource. And that was, of course, when we emptied those and we couldn't get any water up, that's when we wish we hadn't emptied them. But it became a question of self-preservation then. That was the best instance I could ever remember of self-preservation, when you got so far ahead then, you lost contact with anybody to help you, and you were really on your own. And it was your own resources, and that's what we did when we found that we got in these villages sometimes. And but one thing that struck me about, and I ran into three empty villages that we advanced and took possession of, the atmosphere, the eerie silence, no living people about, nothing moving except a bloody dog nosing his way around. And some of the places down through shell fire, damaged and all that, signs of human occupation, but no humans. And that's when the picture hit you, if you'd got any imagination. And I don't know, I suppose I've always been a bit observant and reactive to atmosphere and temperament and all this. And it made an impression on my mind. And I walked into, we'd rested down in a place on one occasion when we were advancing there, and we were waiting for orders, and I wandered, you know, around further up, well, perhaps I shouldn't have gone now or been out of bounds, but I just walked into these streets here, and it struck me, you know, what's this all for? You know, it's all crossed your mind. This is eerie, you know, it's not natural, this sort of thing. And I thought myself, as I walked through, I wonder if it's a bloody sniper got his eyes on me now, sighting me and his rifle. Because we were always warned, and your training always came back to you. The little training we had was very effective, and the old sweats left us in no doubt. Don't think you're the only one who's going to get away with it. Because if you the numbers on it and you put yourself in the way of it, then you're asking for it and you'll get it. And so it struck me then, you know, a terrible thing that you, especially where the people's houses were being burnt down, because Jerry was vicious sometimes in his... it all depended on the kind of regiment I found that was in front of you. You could usually tell... there's no decent regiments, I suppose people anti-militarists would say, but of course there are, because where there's any community or gathering of people, you always get a good or a bad element and a preponderance of one or the other, and it leaves its mark. Good leaves its mark in the same way as bad does, and we could tell, you know, if a German infantry had been in front and in possession in front of us, the way they left things. Some places you wouldn't find any booby traps, even. Another place they'd be riddled with them. I mean, a bloke got blown up at the piano in my particular company, and he could play. He was our best pianist. This is what upset us, you know. And of course, the first thing he did when he saw the bloody piano, Jerry was way back, you know. The place was deserted. Of course, he walked in, he lifts the lid of the piano, and of course, away he went with the piano as well. And of course, a couple of his mates who hardly got in the front door heard the explosion and went in. They saw what was there, nothing practically, with piano smashed open. And he never got a chance to press and bang a note on the piano. And they rushed out and told us, keep your hands off everything, you know. It was a good lesson. He saved a lot of lives probably by doing that. We don't know. But everything was booby-trapped and nothing was allowed to be touched. And engineers were warned straight away and they had to go in and defuse all these...
What sort of booby-traps did you come across or hear about or find?
Drawers in chests of drawers. Doors were wired. Windows sometimes were left half open to invite you to lift the window and climb in, you know, if you were going to search the house, and they'd go off, you know, in the room, in the floor would go up. The pianos were favourite, anything like that, you know, where there was an attraction, and or bureaus, if you lifted a bureau up, it could go off. And even the floor, under mats and all this kind of thing. Everything. Jerry was a master at booby traps, there's no doubt about that. And we fooled ourselves a lot at the beginning by thinking that, oh, we wouldn't think of anything like that, you know, and that's why we were warned to be very, very careful.
Did you find it those yourself, or were those the sort you were warned about?
No, I didn't come across any. I mean, unfortunately, it went before me. As soon as one went off, you know, you didn't touch anything then. And you didn't start the experiment to see if there was one there, because you'd assume that there was, which was the right attitude, you know. And all we did was to flash the message back. The NCOs made sure it got back to the officers' headquarters, battalion headquarters straight away, and engineers and squads came in, you know, and defused everything. Because afterwards we had to use those places as billets very often. It all depends. And this advance went on for weeks, mind you.
Now, you said that you could tell what nationality or what regiment or type of regiment was in front of you.
Well, we knew.
Which was which? How could you tell?
Well, when I say that, I'm not talking about the classification of the regiment so much as I am the temperament of the people in that regiment, by virtue of the fact that if you went into a village and there was no booby traps, you knew that They wasn't concerned, but just about as fed up with the bloody war as what you was. And they just didn't bother. You know, they knew they were retreating. And I suppose the same as our people did, you know, when the Jerry advanced on us, as he did in the early part of that year, just before I got there, and on that front anyway. And, you know, it might have been a question of circumstance or pressure. On the other end, you got visible instances of vicious planning, you know, for destruction of yourself and the enemy and all that. I mean, you could understand a machine gun poster, Jerry digging himself into a front garden like I met on the advance there, at Epi particularly on that morning when the fog opened and there was Jerry in front of machine gun facing me and I opened fire first. It was split second stuff. Bloody gun was pointing at me and there was a couple of three Jerrys there. If they'd have opened up just a fraction before me, me and my team would have gone and I wouldn't have known anything about it. But as it was, I just swung the gun round automatically and that was it. Not a sound. Thankfully, I moved on. I took a quick glance, you know, and they were finished.
That was with the fog lifting.
In the front garden in Epi, that was. I always remember that because it was such a nearest escape I ever had. Apart from Chipperley Ridge, when, of course, we got wiped out. But, you know.
But there was no national characteristic for Saxons or Prussians or anything like that?
No. No, you couldn't tell unless you were told afterwards what regiment had been in front of you. Or you saw some of the prisoners coming back. And even then you couldn't recognise their signs. I mean, you didn't know enough about them, you know, for that. All you knew, they were Jerrys. And I, in the main, I respected them. I thought they were good fighters. And you do respect a good fighter.
Well, during this period of... I mean, was it... This was open warfare then?
This was it? Yes.
Did you miss the trenches? Because you'd started off in the trenches. Did you miss that that cover, the security of cover that trench gives?
Well, you didn't worry about cover then, funnily enough, you know. You felt safer when you were up on the ground advancing than you did when you were stuck in the trenches. In the trenches, you couldn't move. You were a sitting target, and that's why we lost such a lot of men. They were belting us day and night, you know. Sometimes a barrage would start and last for about 3 or 4 hours without a stop. And, you know, we would be the same. Our guns would belt back at them, and it'd slow down. Then machine gun fire would open on the other side.
What you mean is that when you were in open warfare conditions, they didn't know exactly where you were, so they couldn't subject you to that sort
of... That's right. They couldn't target you. You see, and you couldn't target them. All you knew that anything in front of you was the enemy, and if it moved, you fired at it. And the same with them. If they saw anything moving in front of them, they'd fire because they knew we were going after them.
Are there any other incidents from this period of open warfare that illustrate the fighting or what was happening to you that you can recall to mind?
The sort of what thing?
Incidents that were happening. Any of the fighting?
No, it was a uniform pattern. And this is why, in a way, we accepted it, I think, you know, because you raised the point just then, you made a good comparison. What was the difference between trench warfare and your attitude and being in open warfare, where you were... The type of warfare in open warfare was completely different to the trench warfare. You had a sort of freedom, funnily enough, if you can call being on the battlefield in action freedom. But you had freedom to move and advance, and you were on, to a certain extent, you were on your own, although you still had your NCOs with you, and they were under orders as well. But you had one objective in mind, that was to go forward. And that was completely took priority over every other consideration. And things that happened were passing phases in the same way you pass a person in the street and you take no notice of it, you see. From time to time when you were advancing, there was an action going on, and this took place day after day, you know, and you had your different objectives to take, and whatever came in the way, you had to take it, you know, irrespective, and you either got held up or you were able to fight your way through. And from time to time in the advances, you had spectacles of parties of Germans, as I say, coming through, you know, with their hands behind their heads there. And, or if they'd been coming for some time, they dropped their, obviously they didn't have to hold their hands behind their heads all the time, but I think they were as scared or perhaps relieved at getting taken as some of our chaps were, I suppose, when they got taken in other actions. But it was a nice feeling to be able to go forward and stand stuck there in the trench and just being fired at the will and whim of the enemy. And I suppose they thought the same way.
How did the situation where you were surrounded resolve itself? You mentioned the battalion hall.
Oh, yes, when you were bogged down, I mean, you were warned then, you know, keep your eyes open, and we had a rear section guarding back, front and sides. In fact, they couldn't get any water up to us at one time, and the tanks had to bring it up to us at the finish. This was during the August the 8th advance, because we didn't just walk forward as if there was nobody there. I mean, Jerry really put some spots and points of resistance up that were really fierce, and he just wasn't going to give up until he was knocked out. Some of them wouldn't leave the gun post, and we finished them off because they wouldn't leave. That's all we could do. And I remember when the tanks brought the water up to us, you could taste the petrol, because it came up in petrol cans. Was it sweet? I never thought water would be so valuable until that happened.
So how did that, when you were surrounded, how was the situation resolved? Did just more people come up to support from behind, or what?
I'm not sure whether we had to retreat on that occasion or withdraw, because it got too hot for us, and we were relieved from the back where we could get out, and that was the only place we could be relieved from, those coming up at the back, you know, when they were near us. And I think that's what happened when the tanks came up and brought the water up. I think they turned around and went back again, and we were ordered to withdraw. And I can't remember vividly. Things happened so quickly then, you know. And for this action, as I say, was continuous. You couldn't register. It happened so fast, nobody would believe it, I suppose. Because they, normal people, when in a peaceful atmosphere like we are now, they can't appreciate what it's like to be in a position where you're bogged down. If you move, probably your life depends on it. And you can't go forward, you can't go back or sideways. You've got to wait till you get orders to do something, and you do what you're told and hope for the best. And this is what happened, and you hadn't got time to record incidents as such, isolated, because they affected everybody in the same way, you know, and you took it for granted, all right, this is what's happening, and you cope with it. And, as I say, if your star was shining, you were in.
You say that things were happening quickly. Did you get any chance to sleep, to get rest during this advance?
Yes, well, of course, during the night time, there always advances stopped. You didn't advance, you always packed down, wherever you were, whatever you were doing. You didn't advance during the night because you couldn't see anything anyway, and it was damn silly to go ahead.
So how would you protect yourself from any German advance or raid?
Patrols, always had a patrol out, and we were so much on the run, and Jerry never sent patrols out then. He was really either consolidating himself making his mind up he'd resist us at that spot, or else he'd go and, you know, have a general... ordering a general retreat. We knew that by the signs. And some of the plays that were being burnt and all this to stop our progress. Ammunition dumps were being blown up by him. Bridges were being blown. We had to go across the canals and any waterways on drums, you know, that were tied together, rafts, any damn thing that would float we could get onto. And during the night, that's when we'd get our rest, because we immediately adopted the 2-on-4 off routine of sentries, and that's how we got our sleep. And we didn't last a couple of seconds when we sat down or laid down. We were off. Didn't matter what conditions were like, good, bad, shelter or no shelter, rain or no rain. When you're tired,